This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Welcome, everybody, to Jikoji. Welcome, everyone online as well. Here we are, Sunday morning at Jikoji. Last week, we talked primarily about practice. We've started our winter practice period here at Jikoji. And the theme of the winter practice period is continuous practice on the path of inconceivable liberation. The inconceivable liberation part refers to a sutra we're studying, the Vimalakirti Nirdesa, the holy teachings of Vimalakirti. And the continuous practice part of it, I broke down last week because I thought in order to talk about continuous practice, we had to understand what we mean by practice. But in thinking about it this week, that might have been an error on my part, because I don't think you can separate continuous from practice. Many of you are new, I guess, and attended your first meditation instruction today. And Sokyo gave you instruction how to sit an hour sitting meditation, which is called Zazen. And it comprises mostly a lot of attention to posture, how you create a foundation for yourself, how you hold your body, basically with the goal of relaxing your body, making yourself stable so you can be present in this moment. Last week I talked about Zazen. I talked about the importance of vow or intention to our practice, talked about the precepts, the paramitas, and mindfulness. Those are all important things. Those are our forms. They're part of our practice. But, well, actually, I first wanted to talk about why we're here. I think many of us, I know myself, first came to Zen practice because I wanted to fix something. I wasn't the way I wanted to be. I was experiencing some kind of suffering I didn't feel I was in control of. By suffering, I mean more likely dissatisfaction. And I came to Zen practice with the hopes and the idea that that Zen practice would fix me, would give me what I want, would make me better in the way that I wanted to be better. And that is a perfectly good and natural reason for coming to practice. It's a very practical, utilitarian motivation for practice. We look at practice as a tool, in that case, to help us get what we want. We think about practice as something that we do. I do practice. And if I do practice hard enough, perhaps I will get what I want, be a better person, be happier, and all that stuff. And I'm not saying that couldn't happen. That might happen. You might get what you want, or you may end up wanting what you get. It's unclear. And actually, quickly, there are concrete things we can do. We can do, air quotes, do in our practice. And I will enumerate some of those later. But I wanted to talk about practice being so much more than that. It's sort of a paradoxical thing, our practice. Because sure, there are forms you saw, we bowed together, we offered incense, we chanted, but that's not all of our practice. It's Our practice is paradoxical in the sense that the way that we envision our practice, or the way we hold our practice, is with the attitude that we can't do practice. Practice is being done. When Buddha awoke, on the morning he awoke, he said, "I and all sentient beings awake." So everything is practicing right now. It's paradoxical and kind of weird way of describing it. It's kind of woo-woo, like everything is practicing. But how it's hard to it's difficult to describe it, except for I can tell you from personal experience that the more you try to do practice, the more you try to grunt your way through practice, the more you do that, the more you tend to hold on to what you came into practice with, your preconditions, your conceptual way of seeing things, your fixed ideas, your attachments. Practice is a gift to us in that we don't have to do anything. We just have to receive it. In fact, you can't really do anything. It's happening all the time. Practice is happening all the time. So if you can't do anything, how do we know that we're doing practice? How do we know that this is the way? I'm not doing something. Am I practicing? Am I not practicing? Are you practicing? Are you not practicing? It seems if I'm telling you that everything is practice, then how do we know we're participating in the way to awakening, the way of awakening, not to, of? Well, the way is the way, what we call the way, which is our way of practice. It's vast. It's open. It's available. It's mysterious. And at every juncture, we try to limit it. We try to reduce it. We try to put it in a box. We do that with our, how we approach every moment, with our, the fixed ideas, our habits, our preferences, our karma. Karma, in the sense that I described last week, as not something from another lifetime, but the things we're given, the parents we have, the way we were brought up, our physical body, our habits, our preferences, our culture. That's all, we adopt all that as we grow. We limit this every moment with these various preconceptions and what have you. Every moment contains a possibility. Every moment is a door. Every moment offers itself to you. Sometimes I think that we approach practice. We struggle so hard. We feel like there's something to know, there's something to do. There's this wall we find ourselves pushing ourselves up against. There's this wall that's keeping us back from whatever it is we think we're going after. And we want to find the way through this wall. But the wall really has no door in it, because the wall is you. You're the wall. So there's nothing for you to do. Nothing at all. Practice is more like a letting go and a shedding, kind of a shedding. It's more of a shedding process than a doing process. It's kind of like I was thinking about such a hard way to talk about practice. And it seems like in this, how do I give you an idea of like a practical aspect of practice? And I don't know if this works, but I can't, like sometimes, especially as you get older, you struggle to remember a word or the name of something. I went for like 3 days trying to remember the names Fats Waller, and eventually it popped into my head. But there's this technique people will tell you, well, stop trying so hard. Don't think about it, and the word will come to you. And honestly, that does work. Time and time again, the moment we try, we stop struggling, we stop grasping, reaching for that word, it appears magically. And that's kind of like practice. My wife says I say a lot during my Dharma talks. She watches it and gives me a little analysis and so I should probably start saying om. So as far as continuous practice goes, I don't know if I said it, but I meant to say that everything seems to be practicing but us. The world is practicing, the rivers and the mountains and the squirrels, the birds, the air, the sunlight, the stars, the other galaxies. This is all practice. And we're like the one, because we're able to conceptualize and to separate ourselves, we're the one sentience that doesn't practice all the time, except for we do practice all the time. We just forget about it. We forget we're practicing. So, as far as continuous practice goes, I would just like to suggest you're already doing it. And I would like to suggest that you approach each moment as a possibility. Each moment has a potential for something. As long as you're not squeezing it, painting it, coloring it, saying what it is or what it isn't, allow itself to present itself to you. It's a gift. Okay. So my suggestion for continuous practice, for doing continuous practice, is first to have that attitude. Last week I talked about vow, and I grouped the word vow together with intention. And it's my opinion that vow and intention is absolutely critical to practice. Your entire experience, your karmic experience from this lifetime is like a tide on the ocean, and it is pushing you in one direction, and it is a mighty tide. The culture you come from, your history, your experiences, the way you're chemically composed makes you sensitive or less sensitive. That creates karma for you. So there's this tide that's pushing you in this direction. And so vow, like the vow that we will be taking later, which is the Bodhisattva vow, a vow to save all beings. When you take a vow, basically a vow to continue on the way, to save all beings. When you take that vow, it's not like a doing thing. It's like an orientation. So you've got this tide, your karmic tide is bringing you to shore. You make this vow, you set your compass in this direction. And that's the direction you've made a choice. That's the direction that you've decided to go in. So, with vow, of course, is intention. And with intention is attitude. So, we go throughout our lives with an attitude. So, the attitude you normally have, especially us Americans, is I can do this. I got it. Or actually, maybe some people have the attitude, I can't do this. Oh no, not good enough. So you either can or you can't do this. And I would say you're right. But I would say that your attitude for practice is more, I think it serves you better to hold in your heart and in your mind. This is not something that you do. This is something that you allow. So, every moment that you can, through mindfulness, be aware that you are constantly being presented gifts of possibilities. It's up to you to receive them. So, that's an attitude. First part of continuous practice. Second part is trust, dedication, devotion over time. Just because I say you can't do practice doesn't mean that you can't do practice. I'm sorry, just tell you that. There are things that we do. We sit zazen, having a sitting meditation, preferably on a daily basis, is super important. And so are the things I talked about last week. Certainly, the vow and intention, the idea of precepts, idea of things that sort of regulate your life. They're not like the Ten Commandments or anything, but they work in symbiosis with zazen to keep you oriented in the direction that you've chosen. So over time of doing zazen, day after day, by doing thinking about the precepts, keeping your vow, perhaps doing devotional practice, you will develop a trust and a faith. And that's super important because that will keep you in good stead. But it doesn't happen overnight. It takes a long time of continual practice. So, attitude, I can't do it. And then an actual practice that you do. Because we are beings, we do things. Another part of continual practice is what we're doing right now, is doing practice with other people. It's not something that works very easily alone. The support of spiritual friends and a teacher is incredible. So think about practicing in a group. There are many groups. And then finally, the thing that I'm really focusing on, or we're focusing on in this practice period, is bringing mindfulness to our daily practice. Meaning, we sit zazen in, perhaps we have an area in our home that we sit zazen, or in the zendo, whatever, and we sit that. And it's not like we sit 30 minutes, then we get up and we get on with our day. Ideally, we continue zazen when we stand up. And the way we continue zazen is through mindfulness practice throughout our day. to be aware of the workings of your own mind, your own emotional body, the way you're relating to what's around you, that sort of thing. And I'll talk a little bit more. I'll give you a couple of concrete tools, I guess. So the last thing I'd like to say at this point about continual practice is stop holding on. It's easier than you think, and it's also harder than you think. But stop holding on. Just let go. So in this practice period, we're studying the Vimalakirti Sutra, which is an awesome sutra. I'm in love with it, which is saying something, because Buddhist sutras can be very dense going. And for someone like me, it's kind of hard to get through some of the heavy duty philosophy. But this sutra has lots of heavy duty philosophy, lots of very deep Buddhist thought. It's still accessible. It's only about 100 pages. It's a story about, well, Buddha opens up the sutra. Buddha makes an appearance at the very beginning, and he makes an appearance at the very end. The rest of the sutra is about basically this lay person. So he's not a monastic, he's not a monk, a priest, anything like that. He's a man named Vimalakirti, who lives in a village in India 2,000 years ago, approximately. And he is considered a lay bodhisattva. We talked about bodhisattva last week. A bodhisattva is one who makes a ridiculous vow, a vow to save all beings, a vow to put off her own or his own escape from the karmic wheel of samsara in order to save all beings. Only problem is, beings are numberless. There are no end to beings. So there's no end to his vow. He's chosen this ridiculous vow to free all beings. On a kind of relative level, that seems ridiculous. On a more absolute level, it isn't, because the conception that we are not separate, we are not separate, means I can't wake up until you wake up. We do it together. It's like Buddha woke up with all beings. So he's this bodhisattva. He's this guy who's very advanced in his practice, and he goes throughout the book basically schooling the disciples of the Buddha and the bodhisattvas on their dharma teaching. And it's quite a humorous sutra. There's a section where a goddess changes genders with Shariputra, the disciple Shariputra. So Shariputra all of a sudden becomes a man, and a woman, and she becomes a man. Can you imagine? 2,000 years ago, how shocking that would be. And it's an awesome chapter. It's very modern thinking. And it's fair. There's a lot of magic. There's time travel. There are other universes. There's a whole, I call him a hologram, that's created, that travels to another universe and brings stuff back from the other universe. This other universe, which actually we call a Buddha field, is an awesome place. It's awesome because in a Buddha field, the Buddha field is managed by a bodhisattva or a Buddha. He's responsible for every sentient being in that Buddha field. And his job is really to teach them the Dharma in the hopes that, not in the hopes, in the in the with the idea that of enlightened, having everyone enlightened. So in this Buddha field, the disciples, the bodhisattvas, are not taught the Dharma through words or through actions or various rules and what have you. They're taught through perfume. All they have to do is sit, perhaps leaning against a tree on a beautiful afternoon, and breathe in this perfume that emanates from the Buddha, and bang, they're there. So it's an awesome place, right? So this holographic bodhisattva that was created by Vimalakirti travels to this land in order to get something, to get their some food and bring this food back to planet Earth. And the Buddha's quite generously says, sure, take this bowl of rice back. And all the 90 million bodhisattvas in this Buddha field, 90 million, they heard stories about how this Saha land, this land that we live in, they heard stories of, like, it's such a weird place. All people are attached. They have fixed ideas. They're constantly creating suffering. Buddha has to constantly give Dharma talks in order for them. They have to practice their butts off, blah, blah, blah. It's such a strange, we want to check it out. And so magically, Vimalakirti brings the 90 million bodhisattvas and Buddhas back to this earth. And they're like, wow, this place is pretty crazy. We're not sure we like it. We don't really get it. But what they discover and what they come to appreciate is that, sure, this is land is not filled with perfumes and lovely, wonderful ways to be enlightened. This world is filled with all sorts of opportunities for people to awake. Okay, this it's just it's like a perspective. It's like having the veil lifted up from your face, and you see things in a different way. This world is as wonderful and beautiful and glorious as the perfume kind of tilty world that these bodhisattvas came from. We have the opportunity to wake up in a way that's very profound, and the bodhisattvas came to appreciate it. So that's just one part. I just kind of got carried away with that part because I think it's crazy. By the way, I didn't tell you that Vimalakirti shrunk those 90 million bodhisattvas in a mustard seed in his hand and brought it to the to our world. And then, like one of those sponge things that you put in water, the kids have, and then it pops open and they all get to their regular size. But the magical thing is they don't take him in any extra room up on this earth. They are all able here to observe and to be here, but they're not crowding us out. So it's pretty cool. But the point of this, hopefully there's a point, is that how does this intersect with continuous practice? So I explained how continuous practice is so easy. You don't have to do anything, right? It's just open yourself to every moment, every possibility. But this world is crazy. It's filled with contradictions. I find myself constantly in situations that are incomprehensible to me. I don't want to get into the specifics, because it would bring the politics of the world into the Zendo. I think that's really awful at this point. But we all know, like these bodhisattvas witnessed on the earth, We all know that there's suffering and that we create the suffering, or he or she creates the suffering. And so continuous practice means that we're in the midst of all that. And how do we go? How are we in the midst of all that? How do we figure it out? You know, because it's overwhelming. So the ultimate lesson, without going into too much detail in this sutra, is one of tolerance, or patience rather than understanding. The skill to abide in this world, to hold these two contradictory things, the fact that we're not separate, the fact that we don't have to do anything, holding that at the same time that we know we have to do something specifically in this moment. We have to hold those, I won't say instructed, but it is suggested that in the situation like this, comprehending it is not possible. Understanding it is not possible. Abiding it in it, being tolerant of it, being patient with it are the skills that we want to develop to deal with these difficult situations. I have all sorts of little things to read from this sutra to kind of give you a sense of what this is about. In fact, actually, I'll just read this one little part. In fact, there's actually a part where Vimalakirti is asked, Manjushri, which is a bodhisattva of wisdom, a very important and wise bodhisattva, asks Vimalakirti, "Noble sir, how does the bodhisattva follow the way to attain the qualities of the Buddha?" So by that, he's talking about how does a bodhisattva basically wake up? How does he have the qualities of the Buddha? All the ideas are the qualities that we think of, you know, like wisdom, morality, patience, generosity, various things like that. And Vimalakirti answers in this really contradictory way. He says, when the bodhisattva follows the wrong way, he follows the way to attain the qualities of the Buddha. And Manjushri goes, how does the bodhisattva follow the wrong way? Now, shouldn't he be following the right way? And Vimalakirti gives about a bazillion examples of it. But I'll pull some out. The Bodhisattva may follow the ways of desire, yet he stays free of attachment to the enjoyments of desire. So that's a good example. You know, our practice is not about not appreciating what we're given. Not appreciating all these wonderful gifts that this body allows us in this, it's about attaching to those gifts to the point of creating suffering for yourself and others. He may follow the ways of hatred, yet he feels no anger to any living being. He may follow the ways of folly, yet he is ever conscious with the wisdom of firm understanding. Basically, he's saying that a bodhisattva is of this world and not of this world. So I'll leave it at that because we're getting close to the end of the talk. I just wanted to give a couple of ideas about things you can do as far as practice goes. So these folded up crinkly pieces of paper are gathas. They're mindfulness gathas that were written, that come from the Plum Village. I don't know if it's called a lineage or not, but it's Thich Nhat Hanh. Maybe some of you have heard of the teacher Thich Nhat Hanh, who passed away well, 3 years ago, I think. A gatha is a short poem, I prefer the word poem to prayer, that that in this case, not God does not always have this as a reason to be, but in this case, helps bring you back to this present moment. There are things you can say as you're going about your day doing things. For example, I'll read, and they're very simple, and they're not philosophical. The words are less important than you waking up or to that moment. So, for example, waking up. So you open your eyes in the bed. Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. I vow to live fully in each moment and to look at beings with eyes of compassion. Or where's them? Washing your hands. Water flows over these hands. May I use them skillfully to preserve our precious planet. So there are two things. One is they're very positive, and they encourage you in a way of not creating suffering, but perhaps reducing suffering. So acting in a positive way, and they help bring you back to this moment. Because, you know, so much, like I said last week, so much of our life is spent doing other things. I think John Lennon has a really good quote on that, which I can't remember, that expresses that thought. I mean, I'm doing this thing, but I'm thinking about lunch, or I'm doing something else. So these help bring you in this moment where you're in your body. Thich Nhat Hanh is a great advocate of smiling, and I really agree with him. If you, and I don't mean like grinning, I'm not saying, you know, grinning, but I mean, there is, you know, there's basically no separation between mind and body. So when you smile, there is an effect you have. I highly recommend smiling more. So these are gathas. You can actually get these online. If you go Plum Village Mindfulness Gathas, you'll probably be able to come up with them. I don't recommend having like 40 of them because in your pocket, because you won't remember them. You know, pick out three or four or five to memorize and to use on a daily basis. Mindfulness walking, also one of Thai or Thich Nhat Hanh's ways of teaching is walking mindfully. We did a little bit of that in Keen Heen today. We did it super slow. I don't think when you're walking outside, you need to walk as slowly as we did. In fact, I don't think it's about the speed. I think it's about the mindfulness, paying attention to your in-breath and your out-breath, paying attention to the sensations on your body, the temperature of the air, whether there's wind, what you hear, how the earth feels beneath your shoes or your feet. So that is another tool you can use. Personal kind of tool is gratefulness practice. I don't know if this is exactly Zen, but it's a practice of basically assessing what you've been given on any particular day, and perhaps writing it down, perhaps being aware of the gift and feeling grateful for it. Stuff like that. The loving kindness meditation, we chanted the loving kindness meditation or sutra. There's actually a meditation. One of their four, called Brahma Viharas, or the four immeasurables, loving kindness meditation, a meditation on sympathetic joy, and so forth. But the loving kindness one, the one we basically chanted, which is, you can look it up, but basically you sit in meditation and you wish that all beings be happy, and you wish that all beings be peaceful and at ease, and you wish that all beings feel safe and that they know loving kindness. And you can start with yourself or you can end with yourself. I think sometimes it's harder to have those those feelings for yourself, and perhaps easier for a friend or a loved one. And you can go out from the friend to the loved one, to people that perhaps you don't have a good relationship with, and you wish them happiness. Because whatever they're doing, whatever suffering they're creating, originates in ignorance. If you understand that, perhaps compassion will come easier to you. So that is continuous practice. A little bit on the Vimalakirti Sutra. Highly recommend it. I think we have time for questions. If anyone has a question about continuous practice or the sutra or aliens or anything. Oh, yes, someone online. Yes, Patty. Oh, hi, Patty.
You're on mute. Patty, you need to unmute yourself.
I know, I'm on my phone, which is unusual for me, and I couldn't find the button. I'm just wondering if the John Lennon quote you're looking for is, life is what happens when you're busy.
Doing something else?
Making other plans. Yeah.
Making other plans. Yeah. Life is what happens when you're busy making other plans. That's John Lennon. Yeah.
Favorite of mine, too. Thank you for your talk today.
Thanks, Patty. Anyone else?
Thanks for your talk. I'm curious if you have any guidance for how to integrate the ethos of continuous practice outside of Zazen to fully receive the emotional qualities of life while maintaining equanimity.
Yeah, I would say how do we develop the skill of receptivity. Okay. So how do we develop the skill to be available to what presents itself to us? I feel like that is really, that's a big question, really, because we have so many emotional ideas about how things are, about how things, we have fixed ideas on about how we think people should show up in the world or situations should arise in the world. And they're really charged with emotion. In fact, it's often my body that is telling me, you know, how I'm feeling in any one situation. Perhaps a receptivity to the feelings in your body, you know, whether sometimes I'm feeling something in my chest, which really is about me reactive anger towards a situation. And I feel it before I'm aware of the anger. Or maybe something like that, just, you know, scanning your body, being mindful of your body, and relaxing your body as well. Like Tai has a meditation, I breathe in, I'm aware of my body. I breathe out, I calm my body. Something like that, maybe. Ethan.
You think the aliens have their own practice?
I think they do have their own practice. I think they do.
Think the aliens have their
own. Yeah, I really think they do. And I don't know what that practice is. Yes.
I'm wondering if you have any guidance on how to practice not grasping.
How to practice not grasping. Mm-hmm. I think it all boils down for me to be aware of when I'm grasping. I think the first thing is to become aware of grasping. And I think that is the Dharma gate in that situation. Because often we don't realize or understand when we're doing something like that, how we're holding on so much. So I would say mindfulness practice directed towards your relationship to things. Yeah, I would say that's the beginning.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.